KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Investigators are still piecing together the details of the collision between a passenger jet and military helicopter near Washington, D.C.
67 people were killed.
Today is Friday, January 31st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. A new kind of pain medication has been approved for sale by the Food and Drug Administration. It is being touted as non-addictive.
They inhibit the signal being transmitted to the brain. Other medicines, like opioids, for instance, work in the brain.
Also, Americans across the country received hate messages via text after the election.
The content was what was particularly shocking. This idea of rounding up people to be put back into slavery, things like that.
Plus, a look at how the state of Texas has sided with many of Trump's immigration initiatives.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Federal investigators have recovered the black box from the military helicopter that collided with a passenger jet in Washington, D.C. this week. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
At a news conference, National Transportation Safety Board member Todd Inman said the recorder from the Black Hawk helicopter looked to be in good shape.
I can tell you from a visual inspection, we saw no exterior damage that would indicate that it was compromised at this time. So we have a high level of confidence that we will be able to have a full extraction from that as well.
The contents of the recorder could help investigators understand what the Black Hawk crew was thinking and seeing moments before impact, and perhaps why they were flying above the 200-foot altitude limit, which led the helicopter into the jet's flight path. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Just months before Wednesday's deadly crash, lawmakers had warned that air traffic over the Washington, D.C. area was getting dangerously congested. Senator Chris Van Hollen is a Democrat from Maryland.
We, of course, have to wait for the final conclusions of the NTSB investigation to determine the cause of this collision. It was clearly avoidable. We'll have to get to the facts.
Van Hollen voted against last year's FAA reauthorization bill that added New Delhi round trips to the airport's daily schedule. Authorities in Pennsylvania say a small plane has crashed into a shopping mall in northeast Philadelphia. Mayor Sherelle Parker spoke from the crash site just a short time ago.
As of right now, we have no reports on the number of fatalities. So right now we're just asking for prayers for any and everyone who may have been affected.
Videos on social media show multiple fires and a thick cloud of smoke near the crash site. Canada and Mexico say they're prepared to retaliate if the Trump administration imposes stiff tariffs on its exports to the United States on Saturday. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Within days after retaking office, President Trump said he would slap 25% tariffs on products from Canada and Mexico unless the two neighbors curbed the flow of drugs and migrants crossing illegally. Roughly $2.5 billion worth of goods cross the U.S.-Canada border each day. Shachi Curl is with the Vancouver-based Angus Reid Institute, which polled more than 2,000 Canadians about the possible tariffs.
They're angry. There is a sense of wanting to fight back. There's a lot of support for things such as retaliatory tariffs.
The Canadian government has threatened its own tariffs on Florida orange juice and Kentucky bourbon.
That's NPR's Jackie Northam reporting. This is NPR. At least five senior members of the FBI have been notified that they should retire or resign by Monday or be fired. The notifications come as the Trump administration is seeking to reshape federal law enforcement agencies. The acting attorney general has also sent termination letters to more than a dozen officials who worked on the federal criminal investigations into President Trump. It's been 5 years since Britain left the European Union. NPR's Lauren Frere reports the country continues to wrestle with the economic and cultural aftershocks.
It was 5 years ago that then Prime Minister Boris Johnson presided over a hologram countdown projected on the side of 10 Downing Street.
The
bells of Big Ben rang out, and Britain officially exited the EU. God save the Queen. Months later, COVID hit, the country locked down, and the UK has never fully recovered from either of those things. But in power now is Keir Starmer, who voted to stay in the EU and wants closer relations with it. He's hosting Germany's chancellor in the UK this weekend, ahead of attending an informal EU summit Monday in Brussels. Starmer will be the first British leader to attend such a gathering since Brexit 5 years ago. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 337 points at the close. The Nasdaq fell 54. The S&P down 30 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at GundFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Investigators are still trying to understand why a military helicopter collided with a passenger jet 2 nights ago at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. For now, federal authorities have restricted helicopter flights near the airport. That's as the search continues for the bodies of the 67 passengers who were on board. NPR's Joel Rose has been following all of this. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Sasha.
Tell us about these flight restrictions.
The Federal Aviation Administration will limit helicopter flights on routes along the Potomac River near the airport, as well as over the airport itself. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said that would, quote, help secure the airspace near Reagan Airport, ensuring the safety of airplane and helicopter traffic, unquote. The FAA says helicopter traffic will be restricted but will not be completely suspended. There will be exemptions for medical emergency flights, for active law enforcement and air defense, or for presidential transport missions that must operate in the restricted area, as investigators continue to pore over this part of the Potomac River where the two aircraft went down.
The helicopter that collided with a passenger jet was a U.S. Army Black Hawk. Was that helicopter flying where it was supposed to be?
It does not appear so. Based on NPR's analysis of flight data, along with new video footage that circulated today of the collision, which show the helicopter outside of the flight corridor where it was supposed to be operating. Instead, it was well out over the Potomac River when it collided with the plane. And sources tell NPR the helicopter was also flying above the 200-foot ceiling that it was required to maintain.
And is it known whether the passenger jet was in the right place?
The plane, it appears, was doing what it was told to do. It was lining up to land on runway 33. Air traffic controllers did ask the plane to switch from one runway to another runway, which did require a slightly different angle of approach. But air traffic controllers who have spoken to NPR say that is not unusual. It is a routine part of flying into this airport and many others. Not anything out of the ordinary, they say.
There are reports that the air traffic control tower may have been understaffed at the time of the collision. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes, several outlets have reported on an internal FAA memo that says an air traffic controller was doing double duty in two separate positions at the time of the collision because staffing was lower than normal. NPR, by the way, has not been able to confirm that memo. The president of the Air Traffic Controllers Union, Nick Daniels, was asked about it today by CBS this morning, and Daniels said he could not address this particular incident, but he did say this.
It is not uncommon for us to routinely combine positions. There is usually someone in a supervisory position looking at the overall workload and complexity in order to make those determinations of what positions we need open and when we need them open.
You know, this is something that would be normal late at night when there is less air traffic. And not just at this airport, not just at DCA, but at many control towers. Whether that was a factor here is not clear. It's something that investigators will likely be looking at. But that was going to take more time.
And Joel, with everything you've just told us, how close or how much closer are investigators getting to be able to say why this happened?
Investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board say they have recovered the black box from the helicopter. In this case, that is a combined voice and data recorder. Now they will try to extract that information from it. And if that works, it should tell us a lot about what was happening in the moments before the collision. The NTSB has also begun interviewing the air traffic controllers who are on duty, but this investigation will take time. NTSB board members have been emphatic that they will not speculate. They will wait for the facts before drawing any conclusions. We're expecting their preliminary report in about 4 weeks.
That's NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose. Thank you for covering this.
You're welcome.
Among the 67 people killed in the collision on Wednesday night were two flight attendants.
My name is Ian, everybody. I am your flight attendant today. I am going to be working with all you amazing people that can't afford first class. Hey, everybody!
Since his death, videos of Ian Epstein's cheery announcements taken by passengers have circulated online.
We got rules on my airplane, so pay attention. There's absolutely positively not to be one ounce of frowning on this aircraft.
His friend and former supervisor, Anna Marie Walsh, told WCNC Charlotte that it just took one interaction with him and he was in your heart.
The other flight attendant was Denasia Elder.
Denasia was such a beautiful person, a beautiful soul.
Raven Woodruff met Denasia during a lunch break when they went through training together, and they became friends as well as colleagues. Raven posted on TikTok that since their initial training, they've been, as she put it, stuck together like glue.
She was telling me she felt like she finally found a job that she loves to do, and just know she was a damn good flight attendant.
Denasia Elder was a wife and mother of two children. She was 34 years old.
Ian Epstein was also a parent of two with his ex-wife. He was 53. Both were based in Charlotte, North Carolina. In the hours after President Trump won a second term last year, Americans nationwide started receiving hate-filled text messages taking aim at their race, gender, sexuality, or religion. Investigators are still trying to find the culprit. Within the digital communications industry, it was an existential crisis. Despite years of cracking down on spam, fraud, and abuse, someone bypassed the guardrails on a mass scale. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin has more.
Dr. Robert Green II says his students were rattled on election night. The candidate that inspired so many of them, Vice President Kamala Harris, was clearly losing.
The atmosphere on campus was incredibly tense.
Green is an assistant history professor at the historically black Claflin University in Orangeburg, South Carolina. After years of escalating dangerous rhetoric from Trump and his allies, the president was back. Students were already scared and unsettled, Green said. Then, they started getting disturbing text messages.
The content was what was particularly shocking. This idea of rounding up people to be put back into slavery, things like that.
The texts were explicit, commanding students by name to work on a nearby non-existent plantation. But it wasn't just Claflin in the crosshairs. It was other minority students, descendants of slaves in North Carolina, members of the LGBTQ+ community, Muslims. Each got a message tailored with threats about deportation, re-education camps, and slavery. It was a tidal wave of hate. Law enforcement is still trying to figure out who is behind the campaign nearly 3 months later. But for people in the mobile communication space, this attack was exactly the kind of thing they had been working to avoid. NPR talked to nearly a dozen people involved in the industry to try and get to the bottom of how this racist mass text campaign might have happened.
And so when I heard, I was like, you know, there's an open door and somebody's going to get in big trouble for having that door be open still.
That's Brad Herman. He's the founder and CEO of a mass texting company called Text 'Em All. Companies like his, hundreds of them, are devoted to sending mass messages. That could be everything from facilitating an ad campaign to helping local officials warn residents about a blizzard.
We send large numbers of texts to groups of folks that want and need to receive those messages.
Herman's company, Text 'Em All, is one link in the chain. There's also the carriers like AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon. And then there's other companies that facilitate messaging. Texting is a lucrative business. That's because it doesn't require anyone to download an app. It's one of the best and fastest ways to directly reach people.
The reality is that text messaging works incredibly well.
John Greenlee is the co-founder at another mass texting company, cheapesttexting.com.
It works so well that it is extraordinarily attractive to criminals.
As Greenlee says, companies aren't the only ones that find texting super convenient and direct. Criminals love to hawk their scams via text message. Fraud got so bad several years ago that the industry joined together to try and solve the problem. Here's Brad Herman again from Text2Mall.
3 years ago would have been almost wild, wild west. So the rate of improvement is pretty impressive.
Behind the scenes, companies have been working to keep track of scammers and shut them down. They're doing it a few different ways. First off, most companies have their own filters scanning for anything malicious. In this case, texting executives I spoke with speculated that the criminals might have artfully crafted their missives to avoid obvious slurs that could trigger alarms.
It didn't have a spammy URL. It didn't, you know, it wasn't asking anybody to click on anything.
There's also something called the campaign registry, where companies now have to register their texting campaigns.
The good news is that all of these systems that have been put in place really in the last couple of years are actually pretty good.
Good enough that Herman's Text2Mall was able to stop the racist mass texters themselves. Herman says the bad actors signed up for a free trial, but were immediately blocked. His company wasn't the only one.
I suspect they tried a lot of different places and realized immediately it was not going to go anywhere.
But they didn't stop there. The bad actors were also using anonymous free digital phone numbers from services including TextNow and Google Voice to better hide their identities and locations. Both companies tell NPR they took action to stop the misuse, but by then the messages were sent and the culprits had vanished. Experts agreed that it's clear the bad actors put in a lot of effort. They were unsettled by the sophistication of the attack. They said it's almost like the attackers were probing the system, looking for flaws to exploit now and maybe in the future. One way they may have done that is by making their texts look like normal traffic between friends or family, a space that's less regulated. Here's John Greenlee from CheapestTexting.com. He uses the term P2P texting. He means individuals sending personal texts, person to person.
It's clear that this really exposes a weakness in P2P texting, especially if it can be sort of co-opted by individuals that are looking to send out mass text messages that don't adhere to, the regulations.
People probably don't want companies to monitor their texts, even to look for possible scams, Greenlee said. It's a huge privacy violation. But they'll also expect companies to do something to make sure nothing like this happens again.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly awful to receive a message like that. It's almost like a mental bullet.
A mental bullet fired at the American psyche. One that might force the industry to act, though it's unclear what that solution might look like. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. The role of First Lady is unelected, unpaid, and usually comes with zero preparation. But Melania Trump is returning to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue with significant experience under her belt. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports on what we can expect from her second stint in the White House.
Melania Trump traveled last week to Western North Carolina to visit communities hit hard by Hurricane Helene.
I want to thank our great First Lady for coming today. She really wanted to be here.
She didn't give remarks. She was seen comforting people who lost their homes, giving hugs. It was an early glimpse of her stepping back into the role. She told Fox and Friends in October, this time would be different.
I have much more experience, much more knowledge. I was in the White House before. So when you go in, you know exactly what to expect.
One big early difference, she moved into the White House on day one. Last time, she waited several months in order for her young son, Barron, to finish his school year.
The perception that she didn't want to do the job before because she came later, I think are all erased now.
That's Anita McBride, director of the First Ladies Initiative at American University.
By breaking precedent, she made it easier for anyone that comes after her to potentially do the same thing. It was a way to advance the position, the same way Dr. Biden advanced it by having a job outside the home.
With Barron Trump now in college, McBride says the First Lady may have more time to expand her portfolio from the first administration, which most notably included Be Best, an awareness campaign about the effects of social media on children, including online bullying, and the impact of opioids on young people. Melania Trump told Fox and Friends earlier this month she wants more backing from the tech industry than she got last time.
I invited all of the streaming platforms to the White House. I had the round table, and I didn't have much support from them.
Attention on Melania Trump wasn't always about her agenda. In 2018, she caused an uproar with a certain, now infamous, jacket. She was visiting children in a migrant detention facility the day after her husband ended his controversial policy of family separation, a move she had privately pushed for. Getting on and off the plane, she wore a green jacket with white splotchy letters that read, "I really don't care, do you?" She later told ABC News the jacket had an intended audience.
It was for the people and for the left-wing media who are criticizing me and want to show them that I don't care.
The First Lady is known for keeping her cards close to her chest. She's already said she's selective about the team she's building around her, a hard-learned lesson after an advisor in the first administration secretly recorded phone calls with the First Lady and made them public. She's recently started to share more details of her life on her own terms. A month before the election, she published a memoir where she shared her support for abortion rights, a rare public break with her husband, who has taken credit for overturning Roe v. Wade and leaving abortion policies to the states. She's upfront about the fact that she doesn't always agree with her husband. Here she is on Fox and Friends ahead of the inauguration.
Some people, they see me as just the wife of the president, but I'm standing on my own 2 feet, independent. I have my own thoughts.
She said she gives her husband advice.
And sometimes he listens, sometimes he doesn't, and that's okay.
As for exactly how she'll proceed as First Lady, here's McBride.
At the end of the day, Melania Trump has always been a woman that has done it her way, and she will pick and choose how she wants to deploy her time and influence, and not what other people want her to do.
One thing's definite. The public is going to be seeing more of Melania Trump. She's currently shooting a documentary about herself. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
This Sunday is Groundhog Day, when thousands of people show up in a small town in Pennsylvania to watch a groundhog named Punxsutawney Phil predict how much longer winter will last. And this year, NPR's Bill Chappell will be there to witness Phil's appearance in person. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Sasha.
So this tradition, remind me, if the groundhog comes out of its burrow and sees its shadow, that means six more weeks of winter. Is that right?
Yeah, and if they don't see its shadow, then it means we'll get an early spring.
Ah, so tell us how many people actually turn out for this.
Well, on Sunday morning, around 40,000 people are expected to visit this town where less than 6,000 people actually live. They're going to go to a hillside called Gobbler's Knob, and that's where Punxsutawney Phil's been making predictions since the 1880s.
How accurate is his weather forecast rate?
Well, not super accurate. The weather agency NOAA says he's right only 35% of the time.
That's not such a great track record. And this is such an oddball event. What is the history of it?
Well, it comes from ancient traditions where they would celebrate the midpoint between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. You probably noticed we've been getting a little more daylight lately.
We have, and I'm very grateful for that, by the way.
Yeah, and in Europe, I mean, people used to watch animals for signs of when spring would come. And in Punxsutawney, they started consulting a groundhog for that purpose. In 1993, the Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day came out, and the crowds in Punxsutawney got 10 times bigger.
Oh, wow, power of Hollywood.
That's right. So the guys in top hats and tuxedos at Gobbler's Knob are in the inner circle of the Groundhog Club there. They run the whole show.
I understand you've talked to some of those inner circle guys. Did you learn any interesting tidbits from them?
Yeah, you know, for one thing, they say that when you see Phil sitting on that tree stump, you're seeing the OG, the original groundhog. It's a bit of inner circle lore. Let's take a listen.
There's only one. And there's only ever been one. There's only ever been one Punxsutawney Phil. Our Phil's like probably 139 years old.
That was Tom Dunkel. He's the president of the Inner Circle.
So wait, Bill, I don't think groundhogs have that kind of lifespan. What does he mean 139 years old?
Well, I did ask a follow-up question about that. And he said that every summer, Phil drinks a secret elixir of life. And every sip of that is supposed to give Phil 7 more years of life.
Ah, so suspension of disbelief about this strange little tradition. So, Phil, this is in the winter, a freezing field, I assume, happens before sunrise. Why does this attract people?
Well, lots of them come for the whole festival vibe, you know, but some come for really personal reasons. Groundhog Day, the film, is a comedy, but Dunkel told me that the story about, you know, Bill Murray's weatherman has to break these really bad habits. The movie changed some of the reasons why people come.
We get a lot of people that come to Groundhog Day for a fresh start and to start over.
So there are evidently lots of reasons to go. And Sasha, I'll be sure to let you know what Phil predicts.
Please do. That's NPR's Bill Chappell. Thank you and have fun this weekend.
Thank you, Sasha.
The Panama Canal, it is critical to global trade. President Donald Trump says he wants to take it back, and his top diplomat is in Panama to make the case. But how do people there feel?
That was something that we weren't expecting, you know, in our 2025 bingo card.
Our very own Ari Shapiro is in Panama, too, and he'll co-host the show from there. He and our team will bring us stories from the canal and beyond. Join us on the radio, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name. This is NPR News.
While many people were evacuating from the LA wildfires, journalists made their way to the front lines to document the devastation. We hear the experiences of two NPR reporters who were on the ground covering the story.
Across the LA basin, you could see the two big fires, and we just descended into a black plume of smoke.
I'm Scott Detrow. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up, we'll assemble a crew to discuss some of our all-time favorite heist movies.
I think that, like, as long as there are banks, there are people that hate banks.
Celebrating the pleasure of a good heist movie after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Another fiery crash tonight involving a small transport plane in northeast Philadelphia. The FAA says six people were on board the medical flight, not two as originally reported. The crash happened just minutes after takeoff this evening in a populated area with strip malls and residential homes. Meantime, in Washington, federal authorities have restricted helicopter flights near Reagan National Airport after this week's collision that killed 67 people. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
The Federal Aviation Administration will limit helicopter flights on routes along the Potomac River between the Woodrow Wilson Bridge and the Memorial Bridge, two of the major spans that serve the region, and over the airport itself. The FAA says helicopter traffic near the airport will be restricted but not completely suspended. There are exemptions for medical emergency flights, active law enforcement and air defense, or presidential support missions that must operate in the restricted area. The restrictions come as investigators continue to pore over an area of the Potomac River where the two aircraft went down. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump's tariffs on imported goods from some key U.S. trading partners goes into effect this weekend. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
The president will be implementing tomorrow a 25% tariffs on Mexico, 25% tariffs on Canada, and a 10% tariff on China.
The tariffs or taxes are already raising the specter of price increases for U.S. consumers as China, Mexico, and Canada are threatening to retaliate with price hikes on U.S. imports. Trump says the tariffs will ensure greater cooperation of stopping migrants from entering the U.S. illegally and the smuggling of chemicals used to create fentanyl. Economists say the cost will likely be passed on to consumers, which could push inflation higher. This is NPR. A new study suggests that when people are having trouble listening to something, a certain ear muscle gets activated. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce explains.
Unlike dogs, cats, and horses, people can't literally prick up their ears. Our evolutionary ancestors seem to have lost this ability millions of years ago. Recently, though, lab scientists put electrodes on the muscles around people's ears and ran some tests. And the electrodes registered tiny amounts of electrical activity in one muscle whenever people were listening especially hard. It was the muscle that, in other animals, lifts the ear up. The research appears in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience. Researchers say a smart hearing aid could monitor this muscle to keep track of how much effort it was taking for someone to hear and then respond accordingly. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Well, the government's inflation yardstick shows consumer prices in December were up more than 2.5%. The Commerce Department report comes just 2 days after the Federal Reserve left its key interest rate unchanged after three rate cuts in a row last year. Economists say the lingering inflation and President Trump's threatened tariffs this weekend on Mexico, Canada, and China could send consumer prices even higher. Stocks finished lower on Wall Street to end the week. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Juana Summers. A new kind of pain medication has been approved for sale by the Food and Drug Administration. It is being touted as an alternative to opioids. It works differently, and it is not addictive. NPR's Yuki Noguchi is here to explain. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Yuki, tell me, how big of a deal is it that this new pain drug is coming into the market?
What makes it a big deal is that it's this brand new alternative and one that's non-addictive, right? There aren't actually that many options to treat acute pain from, like, you know, after surgery or breaking your arm, for example. And opioids are, of course, very effective for pain, but can also be quite addictive. And over-the-counter pills like ibuprofen or acetaminophen aren't addictive, but they come with their own potential side effects on the liver or stomach, you know. So drug makers have been searching for other options to manage pain. And Stuart Arbuckle, who's executive vice president for Vertex Pharmaceuticals, which makes this new drug called Journavx, his company spent two decades developing it. And it works basically by blocking pain signals from the place in your body where you're hurt.
They inhibit the signal being transmitted to the brain. Other medicines, like opioids, for instance, work in the brain.
And he says that's the big difference. You know, this new drug acts on the body without chemically sort of monkeying with your brain. So it sidesteps the risk of addiction.
Okay, got it. But here's a question I have, Yuki. Many people have already become dependent on opioids that have been prescribed by their doctor. So this development, how would this new drug make a difference for them?
Yeah, I mean, this would be a safer alternative. Anesthesiologist Antje Bareveld worries about addiction all the time. You know, she's chief of pain management at Newton Wellesley Hospital outside Boston. And, you know, she says it's a difficult balancing act all the time, you know, managing a patient who's in pain against making sure that they don't get dependent on the drug. And so she's seen, you know, patients go down that path.
Nearly 80% of people who have an opioid addiction started with a prescription opioid. It only takes one prescription.
You know, so if you're one of these people who is at high risk of addiction, say, or someone who's in recovery, this new drug could be very, very helpful. And also, some of Bareveld's chronic pain patients, you know, develop liver problems or stomach ulcers from, like, ibuprofen or acetaminophen. And Bareveld thinks the demand for this new drug will also come from those people because, you know, it doesn't have those side effects.
I even had one patient today send me the article about this medication and said, sign me up, doc.
I do want to ask you, Yuki, about side effects. Are there downsides to this medication?
Yeah, so in clinical trials, the side effects were pretty mild. They included things like itchiness, rash, muscle spasms. I think the far more significant issue for some might be that this is not a very, very strong painkiller. Journavx doesn't relieve pain with the same effectiveness as, you know, high doses of opioids. So that might make it a problem for people with more serious pain. And then there's the issue of cost. You know, it's a new branded drug, which means it's expensive, especially compared to, you know, a bottle of ibuprofen. I mean, its list price for a day's treatment comes to $31, you know, whereas generic ibuprofen costs pennies. So the big question is whether insurance companies will cover this costlier alternative and for whom and, you know, under what circumstances. But given how the new pill, you know, could lower the risk of addiction and other side effects, you know, there's still likely going to be patients who want it.
That is NPR's Yuki Noguchi. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many states are trying to keep pace with all of President Trump's executive actions related to immigration, but Texas has been gearing up for this moment for years. Texas has the second largest population of people without legal status. It also has the largest border with Mexico.
And the Republican governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, is helping the federal government launch what it's calling a historic crackdown on illegal immigration. This week, Abbott issued 5 executive orders that direct Texas to partner with the Trump administration. The Texas Newsroom's Anna Campbell has more.
At a rally just after his inauguration, President Trump stood before a crowd of followers and praised a longtime ally who sat near the front row. As the president spoke, Greg Abbott smiled and gave him an enthusiastic thumbs up.
We won the Texas border that had never been won, as the governor said. He's doing a good job, the governor, by the way, of Texas.
Trump and Abbott have worked closely for years. They've endorsed each other and supported their respective efforts to build a wall along the Texas-Mexico border. And as Trump follows through on a campaign promise to carry out mass deportations, Abbott has become his most eager partner on the border. In 2021, Texas launched Operation Lone Star. The program basically lets Texas use state resources to enforce immigration laws, which have traditionally been enforced by the federal government. Catherine Hawkins is a legal analyst for the nonpartisan Project on Government Oversight. She says Texas is a sort of proving ground for other states that want to get tough on illegal immigration.
Operation Lone Star has really laid the groundwork for a lot of what the administration is now doing on immigration.
This week, Abbott doubled down on using state resources to help the feds detain people in the country without legal status. He's sending 400 additional Texas National Guard troops to the border. He's ordered state police to help federal authorities detain unauthorized immigrants. He's adding things like buoys in the Rio Grande and more razor wire at the border. And he's directed state agencies to share any information they have about Mexican cartels with federal authorities. Here's Abbott talking about Trump on Fox News.
He has a governor and a state in Texas that will be a partner with the Trump administration.
Some of the biggest cities in Texas have said they will follow the law but won't contribute to a climate of fear. Ron Nirenberg is the Democratic mayor of San Antonio, which Texas sued in 2017, alleging it violated the state's ban on sanctuary cities.
San Antonio has always been a city that follows the law. We're also a compassionate city, and so we work with local law enforcement to, when requested, on detainers for violent criminals, but we also provide humanitarian assistance to people who need it in our community. So,
since Trump took office, ICE has detained at least 100 people across the state. In response, advocacy groups have been hosting community meetings to inform people of their rights if they're approached by immigration authorities. According to a recent survey from the University of Houston, about 87% of Texans support deporting migrants who have been convicted of felonies, and 69% support creating more legal pathways to citizenship. For NPR News, I'm Anna Campbell in Austin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Many Americans are interested in the stock market and making money from it, but what if that interest became an addiction? The Indicator's Darian Woods and Waylon Wong have the cautionary tale of a man who got addicted to day trading.
After his big win, Chris Scava started to lose money on his investments. He would sometimes win back money, but over the next few years, he had eventually whittled away all of his savings. So Chris desperately tried to fund even more trading.
At one point, I was spinning 9 of my own personal credit cards and another 4 in my wife's name, which she didn't even know about.
By 2019, the losses were adding up. Chris now owed the equivalent of around $110,000. So he made a vow. He would focus on disciplined bets, wipe away those losses, and get out of day trading. And by mid-2020, he did achieve the first part, paying back his debts. But getting out of day trading, not so much.
In fact, after being laid off from his day job due to the COVID pandemic, Chris started day trading full time.
I went for it, and then unfortunately, within 2 years, all those profits had gone, and I was £145,000 in debt.
Chris called his brother, who urged him to come clean to his wife.
Chris's wife told him to get help. He had some form of a gambling addiction, but in day trading.
I didn't think I was addicted. I didn't bet on horse racing, on sports betting. I didn't go into casinos. I didn't bet on poker. I didn't bet.
But day trading or buying crypto or foreign currencies, that can be gambling. Camelia Kunin is a finance professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
There are studies where, you know, we put people on brain scanners and they're given the opportunity to invest in assets. But we can vary in the experiment. We can vary just how much they look like lotteries or not. What you find is that we are sort of hardwired to fixate on these huge payoffs.
In fact, there's evidence that people are attracted to investing in companies that have had a giant gain, even if it's just once.
Some investors get hooked on the idea that this could happen again, right? That they could get this huge return again.
Further fueling this gamification of the stock market is what's called options. These are special contracts that give you the opportunity to buy or sell stocks at a certain price.
So instead of paying, say, $200 for one Amazon share, you pay $5 for the option to buy the Amazon share for $200 in the future. And so if Amazon's share price goes to $250, that's very good for you. But on the other hand, if the share price of Amazon goes down, that $5 call option could be worthless.
Chris played with similar ways of trying to magnify his wins. What it ended up doing was magnifying his losses.
The average investor, they don't understand all of these payoff structures. The institutional investors on the other side of the trades will take advantage of that.
And after Chris sought help, he realized he had a day trading addiction.
A year later, Chris founded an organization called Project Wellbeing. It runs gambling awareness workshops and helps companies develop policies and support for employees struggling with gambling.
Chris is still married, but he still owes the banks a lot of money. And through his work, not the markets, he hopes to pay his debts back.
Waylon Wong,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
And in the U.S., the National Problem Gambling Helpline is 1-800-GAMBLER.
Support for Planet Money comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. And there is something about a heist movie that is just fun. One of the very first that I remember watching is The Thomas Crown Affair with Pierce Brosnan. I saw it when I was a kid. I still remember it. It had intrigue and style and kind of James Bond.
Do you want to dance? Or do you want to dance?
And most importantly to me in a heist, there was a twist that even the audience did not see coming. I have always loved a heist, and that is something that All Things Considered producer Megan Lim agrees with me on. Megan does not agree with me on all movie things, so that's a big concession. But if you do not agree with both of us, Megan and pop culture happy hour host Glenn Weldon are here to dissect heist movies and explain to us why they are such a crowd favorite. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right, so let's get one of the key questions out of the way first. Like, how do we define a heist movie? What are the key features of a really good classic heist movie?
So for me, there's a few things that are sort of like the hallmark features of a great heist movie. One of the main ones being like assembling the crew. I always think about that like famous montage from Ocean's 11.
And you're gonna need a crew as nuts as you are. Who do you got in mind?
All right, who's in?
And so it's like, you know, Frank, you've got the mastermind, and maybe there's a demo guy, and there's a techie, and there's the guy in disguise. But it's like assembling the crew is a big part of it.
Yeah, but you also need the plan, right? The plan is the big deal. Because the thing about a heist is we're part of it. You know, we're in on it. So we see, you got to lay out the challenge for us. We want to see the security system. We want to see the guards. We want to see the cameras, the alarms.
The elevator won't move without authorized fingerprint identification,
which we can't fake,
and vocal confirmation from both the security system within the Bellagio and the vault below,
which we won't get.
Furthermore,
bonus points if we see a scale model or a blueprint at some point. And then, you know, the mastermind outlines the plan. We get to see shots of what's going to happen if everything goes right. Bonus points if we see watches get synchronized. I'm old school like that.
But I would add, though, that a big part of what I find fun in a heist movie is that, like, you're in on the first plan, which is like this false sense of security, because a good heist movie has a secret plan that you weren't in on. And that's like how everything gets pulled off after the wrench gets thrown into the initial plan, which is fun. It's like almost interactive as an audience member. You're like kind of a detective. You know some of this is gonna go sideways. You know there's a part of the plan that you're not quite being shown yet, and trying to figure that out until the end is part of the fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you want to break it down, Scott, I would say you need a plan, you need a team, and you need a twist.
Second question, how much of the movie does the heist need to take up for it to be a heist movie? If there's a movie where a heist is part of the plot, but not necessarily the central part of the plot, do we count it like two extremes? Like on one hand, Office Space, it ends with a heist to steal the pennies, if it were, from the company. Or The Dark Knight, which starts with this amazing set piece of a bank robbery, but then we kind of move on, and that's just the introduction to the Joker, even though it is like a lifted from the movie Heat, classic heist movie, amazing scene of all the things you talked about in the bank robbery.
I mean, yeah, for me, a heist is definitely a separate genre from a crime thriller where they rob a bank. I think that a large part of it is also the style of a movie. Mm-hmm. It's Brad Pitt leaning against a muscle car in a leather suit. It's not Vin Diesel in a flak suit and a machine gun for me.
You can have the glamorous and aspirational and stylish, like The Italian Job.
You're going to try to crack my safe?
He took my father from me. I'm taking this.
There's a movie I saw 22 years ago. I still remember that everyone drove Mini Coopers, right? It's really the only thing I remember about that movie, but that's the style.
The gold is coming to us. Gridlock every route except for the one we choose. Force that truck to go exactly where we want it to go.
Stop them before they hit the street.
I kind of gravitate toward the scuzzy, the cutthroat, the venal. Like, give me Stanley Kubrick's 1956 film, The Killing, which stars Sterling Hayden as a crook who tries to put a team together to rob a racetrack.
Give or take a few thousand. I figure the loot on this deal at $2 million.
And as he brings in more and more people into the circle of trust, you keep thinking, don't trust this guy. This guy's going to blab.
Broadly speaking, does all of this raise like a mildly uncomfortable, maybe not uncomfortable question? Like, do Americans just like really deep down love bank robbers?
I think yes. Mm-hmm. I think that like as long as there are banks, there are people that hate banks. And I think that it is like kind of a global thing, right? But I do think that there is something that really connects with the American audience of like these old school days of like, you know, robbers in their awesome suits and their, you know, just kind of celebrities. But it also kind of does this double duty of being A, a cool thing, but B, what feels like an almost victimless crime. Mm-hmm. You know, it's who's really getting hurt? Oh, this billionaire who's going to take insurance money and recover like immediately. Right. It's fun for an audience to see the rug pulled out from under them.
Yeah, that's a great point, because no one wants to rob from, you know, George Bailey's building and loan in Bedford Falls, right?
Don't look now, but there's something funny going on over there at the bank, George. I've never really seen one, but that's got all the earmarks of being a run.
Like, if you can picture the guy, you're not going to walk in there, because he's just going to say, well, your money's not here. It's in Joe's house and in Mrs. Macklin's house.
Get on the ground, George.
Exactly. I think everyone has walked into a bank and surreptitiously, consciously or subconsciously, cased the joint, right? This isn't just me, right? You kind of notice where the guards are, where the bank vault is. Am I alone here?
No.
I'm going to put this is hypothetical disclaimer.
You are not alone. I definitely... notice.
No, yeah. I think about more of like the getaway plan. Yeah. I'm like, okay, where would I go? Where I would get in the car? Which way would I run?
Well, there's the appeal of the heist film, right? Because what the heist film offers is process. It also offers you at the same time this illusion that all you would need to do to win over a bank, a big faceless institution, is, you know, meticulous planning and execution, like with no room for human error. Now, that is a very flawed premise. It's the one we shouldn't believe in, but we're Americans. We like to believe in the hard to believe.
All right, let's wind it down this way. We have talked about a bunch of different movies that we love, but let me ask you, is there a movie you recommend that maybe we haven't mentioned yet that maybe is like one of those more sidebar or lesser tier, but still like has all of these ingredients movies?
I got to mention Logan Lucky. It was directed by Steven Soderbergh back in 2017, who also directed my other like favorite classic, Ocean's 11, obviously. Channing Tatum and Adam Driver are brothers in West Virginia who rob Speedway during the Coca-Cola 600.
You Logans mustn't be as simple-minded as people say.
People say that.
Another film more people should have seen is the 2018 film Widows that stars Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, and Elizabeth Debicki. They are widows of Chicago bank robbers who owe the mob a lot of money, so they set out to steal it from a crooked politician played by Colin Farrell.
My husband left me the plans for his next job. All I need is a crew to pull it off.
Why should we trust you anyway?
Because I'm the only one standing between you and a bullet in your head.
Now, what I love about this heist film is that it's messy. We talked about monkey wrenches. This is monkey wrenches all the way down. It starts off the rails and flies even further off them. And there is, to what we talked about, there is a twist you won't see coming that makes you question everything you've seen before in the film. Great movie, Widows.
Glenn Weldon, Megan Lim, I've enjoyed talking to you about heist movies. I'm hypothetically thinking about planning a heist with both of you. I appreciate both of your talking.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation.